when children who are maybe nonverbal and they start to realize that their voice is saying something, sometimes they're just making sounds in the session. And I'm like, you know what? I'm really happy to hear this because, you know, sometimes that's, some parents aren't even getting that. And one of the things that I notice a lot is that children start to play with their mouth and their tongue a little bit more. So there might be that babbling that was missed, that period, that milestone that was missed, that they're now entering. And some parents just love it because the silence, like you said, to sound is, it's so welcome and it's, you know, it's a great thing to hear.
Are you raising your family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Sarah, and today we're diving into a topic that so many families are navigating, often quietly and often with a lot of uncertainty: speech, language, and communication in children, especially those on the autism spectrum. Nearly 1 in 12 children in the U.S. experiences some form of communication disorder. And for autistic children, speech and language support is one of the most critical and most requested services. Today, I'm joined by somebody who brings both expertise and passion to this work, Ebony Turner Bailey, a licensed speech language pathologist and founder of Prime Speech Solutions. Her work is rooted in helping families not just access services, but truly understand and advocate for their child's communication needs. Ebony, welcome. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Let's start with the big picture, because I think many parents came into this conversation with assumptions about what communication should look like. What do you wish every parent understood about their child's communication development from the start?
So I really want parents to understand that communication is more than just words. It starts with those nonverbal things that we often notice, but then also overlook. So, of course, we use pointing, and we use pointing from our children at a very early age. We also look at facial expressions to give us information. We also look at gestures, and all of these things help parents to understand their kids, and they often forget that those are forms of communication. In addition, something that parents really don't think about is behaviors. So
yes,
when your child is acting out, when they are doing some of those gestures in response to their environment, they are really telling us things. And those observant parents, they really notice and they pick up on it and they make changes. And sometimes we just have to check in and notice that our child is telling us more than we realize with just their bodies.
I like to say to parents when they bring up behavior as a form of communication, I'll say they know what they want to say and they know what they want to do, but they just can't say it or,
yes,
or do it. So you've got to look at that too. They're not just trying to misbehave is what I hear. And I think that's such an important reframe. Let's talk about those early moments of communication development, because for so many parents, there's quiet question in the background. Should I be concerned? And one of the most frequent questions I get asked, is my child's speech development delayed?
So, you know, I think that if a question is in your mind, then that means there's the likelihood that there is something going on. And I always tell parents that they need to first consult with their pediatrician. If their pediatrician is not asking those questions, those developmental milestone questions, then you need to come in and ask them, because it's important. Hey, I noticed that, you know, sometimes it is the fact that you're noticing things amongst the other children. And while I don't tell parents to necessarily compare, if you've never experienced, been around other children, then you do need to look at some others to kind of notice where children are generally supposed to be. And so you really want parents to ask those important questions. What should my child be doing at this age so that they understand more of what they should expect their child to be doing?
I know. I get a lot of questions from friends, for example, where an example is one parent asked me if their three-year-old should be talking in full sentences at this point, and asked if it was a cause for worry. And then they're told it's okay to wait and see. And I know that there are early signs of expressive language disorder that parents often miss or even second guess. What are some of those early signs? Can you help us break it down?
So, Dr. Sarah, I really love how you started us, because you started us with the nonverbal, the question about the nonverbal, and that is part of the beginning stages of what parents should be looking for. So if your child is not looking to you around the age, you know what, as late as 12 months, because I really try to say around the age of 6 months, that's when it starts. But, or, you know, you really start to see, oh, my child is, you know, following my eyes and looking, following my movements. But if they're not doing that between 6 and 12 months, it's a concern, because those are the early signs of conversation skills. And you also want to see if they are not babbling by 12 months. It's a little late, but you need a red flag area for you to notice that this is a true concern. You also want to contact your professional if your child is not pointing or gesturing as well by 12 months, as well as if they're not responding to their name. These are all very important, and those nonverbal signs. If your child is not able to say one word responses, so like ball, milk, things that they really love and like to play with or love to eat, by 12 months, these are areas of concern. At 24 months, your child should, if your child is not able to pair two words or even more at this point, this is an area of concern. And if there's any regression, if they've lost any of those skills that I've just said they should have had at 12 months, then these are areas of concern. If they've lost any other skills that you've noticed that they used to do, these are also areas of concern. Everything that your child acquires, they build up off of. And this is what you're looking to see, that it continues. And when you notice, oh, they were doing that a week ago, a month ago, you know, I remember them saying bat, or I remember them saying car, and now they're not saying it. What's going on? You need to speak to your pediatrician immediately.
And I think that's such great advice, and I thank you for explaining it in a concept that parents can understand. When do you first notice, or when do parents first notice, that their child is on the autism spectrum? Like, how do we recognize those signs? I've heard of echolalia and scripting. What, when they come to you, what do you see that they're bringing their child in for?
So it's a number of things, and you're right. Sometimes it is echolalia. Sometimes it is, you know, they're not responding to their name. They're not following directions. They are not speaking, and that's probably the biggest concern. They're not speaking, and they finally want their child to kind of give them some input about their day or something to that regard. And one of the things that parents can begin to notice when a child is on the spectrum, if by the age of three, typically. Okay. But sometimes they're not always clear-cut signs. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it could be other diagnoses that are at play here. And then there's other things, like if your child is exposed to other languages. And so if we're talking about languages, the challenge, we have to look at the bigger picture for your child and understand your child more. So that's why a professional would be best to consult with to determine what exactly is going on with your child.
Very well said. And just to clarify for those listening at home, can you explain what echolalia is?
So echolalia is the repetition of words or sounds that are typically not in context and are typically repeated from something like a TV show or even something that someone has said in the past. It often does communicate language, and we don't often think about that because sometimes, you know, I had a student who would yell, "Go!" like the soccer saying. Yeah. And so they often represent an emotion for a child. And so that is a meaning. And so we learned that when he said "go," that he was excited, but he didn't understand words that we typically use to express excitement. But he understood when people said that, he understood what the behaviors was and what the emotion was behind it. And we, as speech therapists, teach them how to translate that language and that behavior into a more universal understanding of communication. And so that's how echolalia appears in language and for children who display this behavior.
And I am so glad that you defined that for us, because I know for my grandbaby, who is 2.5, she likes, when she speaks, she wants me to repeat what she's saying before she moves on. You know, it's like and I was concerned, you know, is that what we're talking about? It's like a mirroring. And I think that there, we always have to sift through what may be age appropriate versus when to be concerned. So I'm really grateful that you walked us through that. Tell us a story where early intervention made a big difference.
So I can say, honestly, I find early interventions to be so rewarding, because you often start off with a child who is, you know, having some challenges, maybe it's even with play and like sustained attention. And, you know, typically by the end of your experience, they are thriving and parents are exuberant with happiness. Like they're just so elated because they see the progress. And I had several, but let me try to comb through one that I really enjoyed in working with. It was actually a set of twins, and one, they were both autistic, but one was further behind in her language, expressive language skills, and even receptive language skills. And receptive language is understanding, how you understand language. And so typically if your receptive language is delayed, it will affect your expressive abilities. And so, you know, when I would go to the classroom, the teacher would say, "Oh, she won't sit, she won't," you know, she was having difficulties following the norms of the classroom. And so when we first started working together, I followed her all around that room, you know, because she just did not have sustained attention. And through our continued work and repetitive visits and just keeping her engaged, she was able to sustain her attention, and it grew for the entire hour. And she never moved, you know, towards, I would say, even a couple of weeks of working together, she started to gain that skill, and she started to learn gestures and signs to communicate. And those were things that she did not have when we first started. And I, you know, teachers saw the difference, and her parents definitely saw the difference. And it was, you know, a really great experience to watch her grow.
That's such a great story. And I really like the fact that you observed first to kind of feel where the gaps are and then knew what direction to go in. You also mention expressive speech and receptive speech. And I know one of the biggest fears parents have is when their child isn't speaking at all. So Will you define for us and for those listening, what is expressive speech and what is receptive speech? And kind of challenge the idea that expressive speech is the only goal to have.
So receptive language is when a person shows their understanding of language. So that is, do you understand vocabulary words? Do you respond when someone calls your name? These are receptive skills that we do look to see if a child has. And often we look at that before we go into any expressive, because if you don't understand what a ball is, or if you don't understand your name, we have to basically, we know where to start. And then our expressive language is anything that is that communication. So it might be, oh, I'm sorry, one more thing for receptive that we also look at is eye gaze. And remember I said it's important and it lets us know, especially in our society, we use eye gaze to help us know that someone's interested in a conversation, but also that's a part of joint attention. And often children on the spectrum and other children who are delayed, they often have poor eye gaze. And by eye gaze, I mean looking at an object, I'm sorry, joint attention. And they often have that skill, they often lack that skill. And as a result, that needs to be built. And let me go into joint attention before I go into expressive language skills.
If you're a parent or caregiver and want to suggest a topic you'd like for me to focus on the show, please email me at growingupwithdr.sarah@gmail.com or send me a voice memo and I'll play it on the show. And please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a comment if this show speaks to you.
And so joint attention is when your child is looking at an object. You and your child are playing together. They're looking at the object, and then they're looking up at you to see your expression and your response to the object. And so this little area of communication between you, your child, and that object is joint attention. How are they engaged with this? They know that you're there. They know that this object is there. And then they're looking to see, what's your response to this? How are you engaging with this too? And you often see when your child is able to express this skill, you often see smiles and like different emotions. But if your child lacks this skill, then your child will just be engaged with that object. And if you call your child's name, they might just look at that object. They might not even look at that object anymore. They've moved on. So that is one of the things that we look for. And so that eye gaze and seeing if they are looking at the objects, looking at you, they are all receptive skills that we look for. Now, expressive language is something that involves what we said before, some of those pointing and gestures. And if they use sign language, if they've been exposed to sign language, if they even use pictures to communicate, because maybe your child is there, or an AAC device, augmentative and alternative communication device, and also if they use words. So these are those expressive language skills that we look for. And when we say expressive in that way, we mean it, and we're looking for that to determine what your child is able to convey. Those are the ways that we look for that.
I really appreciate you explaining how meaningful communication can look like through nonverbal or minimal verbal expression and reception. I, even as a pediatrician, Ebony, I have to admit that I didn't think about the eye gaze, the joint attention. I believe it's really overlooked. Would you say that's something that many people don't think about?
Yes, very much so. And probably even more so now, because, you know, we're a little bit more disconnected as a society because we're into technology a little bit more. So we're not always catching some of those intents of communication through gaze. And we're just, you know, looking for what can we hear. And so sometimes we lose some points of connection because we're not. We're not aware of that. But I've had, you know, I do want to speak on this too, because I have plenty of autistic children who, when they really have something they want to say or they want you to do something, they are looking in your eyes. And so they understand that that gets you something. But the work, what we focus on is trying to build that so they see that, hey, it's not just you who needs something. We all can work together and communicate and say more than just this that is of interest in this one moment.
Aw, that's so sweet. It really is. And you brought up AAC, or Augmentative and Alternative Communication. What can you share about AAC and what it looks like for children on the spectrum specifically?
So AAC can be as small and as simple as just a picture on a card, okay, or a piece of paper, like a picture card. And often I also add words, because some children can read and you do want to express, you want to express as much as you can and expose them to as much as they can possibly be exposed to. And so it'll have the picture on the card as well as the word that represents that image, a simple word too. I try to keep language very simple and comprehensive for my little friends. And then it can be as technological as an iPad with a verbal communication where it'll express as much as sentences for a person to communicate. And it also uses images as well. And so AAC devices really help because they bridge the gap for those who have difficulty communicating. I use picture cards all the time to help my little ones who have difficulty communicating. And we tend to work on things that motivate them. So typically it's snacks or drinks. And so a lot of times, once they've gained that skill, we often are able to pull out more language because they start to understand, oh, this is getting me something. Mm-hmm. And so they start to express a little bit more because they've seen what language can do for them. And they start to understand that it kind of has a pattern, and they start to use it. They start to, you know, welcome it in addition to, you know, regular sessions. So AAC devices, that's how I typically use it. I've had some students who have come in with the tablet or the iPad, and their goal was to not use that. They wanted to use their voice. So we've really worked with them to help them navigate that journey, because while, you know, that was the form of communication that they were using at school, they didn't like using it at home, and it was more of a frustration amongst them and the family. Mm-hmm. So really finding what your child, what helps your child best, helps everyone, realistically, but also really helps your child feel empowered. And that's what we really focus on in speech therapy.
Yeah, that shift from silence to expression, it feels incredibly powerful.
You know what? It is, Dr. Sarah. And when children who are maybe nonverbal and they start to realize that their voice is saying something, sometimes they're just making sounds in the session. And I'm like, you know what? I'm really happy to hear this, because you know, sometimes some parents aren't even getting that. And one of the things that I notice a lot is that children start to play with their mouth and their tongue a little bit more. So there might be that babbling that was missed, that period, that milestone that was missed, that they're now entering. And some parents just love it, because the silence, like you said, to sound is, it's so welcome, and it's, you know, it's a great thing to hear.
I want to circle back to something you said about the family in general. So let's talk about family-centered care, because I think that's where things get really empowering. How can whole families, like parents, siblings, caregivers, become active partners in the child's therapy?
So I am really a proponent of that. You know, I allow parents to come into the session with the child, if they're not already there, and really see what's going on so that they can understand how to do this at home, how to implement it, ask the questions that they need to ask to understand better. And when I use, especially with the picture system, the AAC device, the low-level picture system, I want families to incorporate, embed that into their daily routine. I've asked moms and dads, hey, if you have older siblings, start to ask them to use the pictures to request things so that if your child is resistant to it, they understand better. But also if the whole house is on the same program, it allows your child to understand, oh, this is what we do? Oh, okay. So now it'll be easier. I encourage parents to ask questions and to feel comfortable to ask questions, because often those questions are valuable in understanding. And we often overlook, like you said, the nonverbal things. And so if you ask those questions, you start to understand, oh, I need to be more, you know, aware and observant. And it helps parents to understand and families to understand how to really navigate this experience.
And I'm curious, can you share a story of a parent who made a big impact in their child's progress? Because the home therapy or what they're doing is an extension of what you're doing in their sessions.
So I'll go back to the student that was using the AAC device at school. And when we first met, he was using one word utterances. So that means just what he was saying, like one word, and it would be like eat, you know, very only his needs. I'm not even sure if he had a lot of wants at the top, but just like eat, water, you know, just those simple things. And his mom expressed that he wants to speak. He does not like this AAC device. We tried at home. He's frustrated. And, you know, his mom and his dad, they work hard reinforcing the things that we practice in our speech room. We work intensively, and he has gone from one word utterances to now he's using sentences to communicate. And that's because his parents really filled in the gaps, and they really supported him and pushed his wants with the goals and the strategies that I implemented. And between our sessions, he more than multiplied in his abilities. And I've really seen a lot of progress with him. You know, now we're on to describing things to expand his sentences even more. And so he can really, and conversational skills. That's another thing that we've been working on and trying to make that a little bit more natural for him so that he can really engage. And when his parents weren't able to show up, an auntie was there. And so there's, you know, I could see how much everyone is a part of this, his growth and this experience. And that is what that's one of my families. You know, I have so many that really put in a lot of effort, but this one, I've seen so much growth in what I would say is a short period of time, because he's made so much progress. And, you know, I think for a long time, he wasn't quite there. So they are ecstatic with his growth. And so am I, quite honestly.
I can understand why. I do. What are some simple, realistic ways parents can support communication at home? I would imagine they would be nervous about doing, you know, what they need to be doing and making sure that what they're doing is correct. So what are some simple ways to support communication?
So some simple ways are, first, I tell parents all the time, first, you got to take things out of your child's reach. If your child was independent, you have to now bring them back some, because no one is going to ask for anything if everything is at their reach. So now you have to start making it a little bit more difficult for them to navigate the house. And so they have to come and get you. They have to call your name. They have to ask for the thing. And so that's one form. Another thing that I like to tell parents is start with 15 minutes a day of one-on-one attention with your child. This is uninterrupted. If you have other children, give them something else to do. Give your child that focus, no distractions, no TV, no background noise. As much as you can limit those extra sounds and focus on your child, that's what you want. And then I also urge parents, if you cannot give them that one-on-one time while they're playing and you're folding the clothes or whatever it is that you have to do, cooking in the kitchen, look over and see what they're doing and talk to them about what they're doing. Oh, you dropped the block? Oh, you're building a castle? Give them the language that they're not going to get sitting there silently, and help them to understand the world that they live in and the world that they're manipulating, because that's even more of a concern. And my last thing, I'm gonna add this one in there. I also like to tell parents that you want to draw connections. So if you read a book last night and it had something about a dog in it, and then you take a walk and you happen to see a dog, it may not look like that same dog, but draw that connection with your child. Oh, look, there's a dog just like we read in, you know, C-Spot book. So drawing connections helps kids to really build their vocabulary, build their memory, and help them to understand, of course, the world around them.
I can't thank you enough for those simple ways to support communication at home. And it's interesting that you brought up the having to request something or seeking out to get something, because I was actually going to ask you, you know, what you thought about that. As I sit here, and I always try to put myself in the position of those that are listening, of parents, and I'm wondering, how do you see your role in guiding parents through this journey of reckoning with their child's autism diagnosis and support needs? Because not everyone is well informed about autism. How do you assist parents getting over the stigma of their child's neurodiversity?
So I do a lot of, it's really tough, Dr. Zero.
I imagine.
Sometimes.
Tough question.
Yes. And sometimes parents are really, they're having a hard time with the diagnosis. And, you know, I try to help parents understand it is, you know, not the end of the world, of course. And I try to expose some of the great things that their child is capable of doing. Some things they learn in the session that their child is able to do that they've never seen before. So I help them to understand, look at what your child is able to do. Look at how much they learn. Look at how quickly they learn, because a lot of times it is a quick process. I do a lot of checking in with parents as well, just so that they understand and get some of those emotions out. Because sometimes it is, this happened, and help them understand how it relates to their diagnosis. And this is important, because the more you understand, the more things make sense, and you just don't feel like you're floating without direction. And I also, if parents are interested, I also offer, you know, there's support groups that I can provide to help them with navigating this experience and feeling, being in a safe space where they can consult with others and get some direction. But I really like to focus on strengths, your child's strengths, and understand and helping you understand those strengths and how that might look in the house, how to carry those strengths into other activities. And those things, I think, really empower parents and really see, oh, you know, it's not that bad, or, you know, my child is able to do, and they know their child is able to do, but sometimes you're just lost in a diagnosis. You're lost in a term. And that, to me, is, it feels like limitation. And I try to see beyond that. I try to help them see beyond that.
It sounds like all of what you're sharing really helps parents and caregivers move from feeling helpless to feeling equipped. And that yes. perspective feels like it changes not just therapy, but how families see their child.
Yes, that's my goal. I want you to see your child as fully capable because they are. They get in here and often cleanup is a slow process. But once they get it, their parents are like, they don't do that at home. No, but setting up routines helps. And in this space, it's definitely a little bit easier because, you know, it's different from at home. At home is a freer environment. Mm-hmm. So if you know that your child is capable of doing that, then that can help you to see where it can look, what it can look like at home. The possibility is there. And the difference between, you know, speech therapy or private practice and school is that your child is doing some of those same things at school, but you just don't know it. You just don't see it. And they may not be always communicated because it's, you know, what's expected. And so once they see it here, they're like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. I didn't know my child knew that word. Yes. And your child knows more. They're just not able to say it yet. But or it's nothing has triggered them to be able to express it. Yes. And so that's what we're here to do. Trigger them so that, and not trigger in a negative way, but like get them talking, right? Get them talking, having fun, laughing, learning, all of the things so that they're communicating beyond what they came here doing.
And I appreciate you sharing that, what neurodiversity affirming care actually looks like. Let's talk about systems. I hate to bring it up, but because even when parents understand what their child needs, accessing support isn't always very straightforward. What should parents know? You mentioned school. So I want to ask, what should parents know before going into an IEP or individual education plan meeting with their school, for example?
So parents may not know anything at all, but if they have an outside provider, they can always ask them to see if they would be available to support them at that meeting. And then also follow up with helping them understand the written report. Going into the meeting, you really want to know, what are my child's strengths at school? Because they could look drastically different from at home. You also want to hear, before you hear about what are your child's challenges, you want to hear those great things mm-hmm. because it helps to align and helps you to understand what they're doing at school and how they interact or how they are best at school. Then going into the challenge, you also want to express yours as well. What are your child's strengths at home and to see how those things can pair up and be implemented in school so that they are performing better. You also want to make sure that you ask all the teachers, what exactly is the expectation for my child and how are they meeting or not meeting those expectations? And then ask as many questions as you can. I always say bring someone with you because you always feel more confident in numbers than you do by yourself. Some people, but you know, sometimes you just need that support and an extra set of eyes. And then you want to be sure that your child is the goals that they have in mind will help your child succeed throughout the year, and it's in line with what you want your child to be doing at, you know, towards that goal for the end of their schooling career.
Yes, and that makes me think about, like, what are some signs a child isn't getting the support they need? What can parents do if they feel something is being overlooked or dismissed?
Okay, so it could look like a number of things overall for an IEP meeting. Maybe it's, you know, behaviors that your child is continuing to present in the classroom or presenting that they weren't presenting before. So like maybe there's something that is not quite right. Maybe your child is not meeting the work is over their heads. They're not able to complete it on time or answer. They're not answering it to the best of their, well, they're doing it to the best of their ability, but it's not at the expectation of your classroom teacher or the grade standards. And so if your child has shown that they, with those supports or with those supports in place, because sometimes they're in place, but they're not getting that, and they're still having problems, then you need to express it to first the professional that should be working with your child to understand what's going on, what does my child look like in the classroom, and what else do we need to do because it seems like they're still struggling. Then, if you're not getting that, then you might want to express it to the department head, the parent liaison, if there is one, and then also your principal. So you want to speak to a lot of channels so people know that you're present, you're aware of what's going on, and you're basically standing up for your child, you're advocating for your child. And so it's a lot of times when school professionals know that you are present and interested, they're going to put forth a little bit more effort and really try to work with you so that your child is getting those needs met.
Yeah, advocacy really becomes a critical part of this journey.
Yes. Parents, and, you know, I just want to add that that's something that parents have to. That's like your number one role, right?
Being superpower. Your child's
Yes. And so while we sometimes leave our children to the professionals and expect it to be taken care of, sometimes that extra presence and those questions are what is needed to get your child where they need to be.
Thank you. Before we close, I want to talk about something every parent listening is probably holding on to, and that's hope. What would you say to a parent who feels overwhelmed or scared right now?
I would say your child is capable of doing any and everything. With your support and guidance and your love, they have the ability to do so much. And so what you have to do is you have to be that advocate and engage with your child. That's one of the biggest things. And know that communication is more than just words. So building that relationship, even on those nonverbal moments or special moments, because I think those are more special sometimes than words, is important. And that I would say parents, try to build those moments as much as you can.
What I take from this conversation is that it's not about changing who a child is. It's about giving them the tools, the support, and the space to express who they really are, who they already are, right? For parents listening, if you're on this journey right now, know this, you're not alone. And your role in your child's communication is more powerful than you ever realize. Ebony, thank you so much for sharing your insight and your experience with us today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sarah. I've had a wonderful time sharing all about speech therapy with you.
Yeah, me too. And I've learned some things as well. And if this episode resonates with you, those that are listening, please share it with another parent or educator or caregiver who could benefit from this conversation. And as always, we're here to support you in raising healthy, confident, and connected children. Until next time, I'm Dr. Sarah, and let's grow up together.
produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.